We're at the end of the day, aren't we? It's it's a full week. Here we are. Well, thanks for coming. I'm going to shut the door and then we'll get rolling. Well, this is really fun for me. I'm a Pepperdine grad. Not too many years ago, and spent, well, Kylie and I worked together at the law school too. Almost a decade of my life out here at Pepperdine, and so it's really my first trip back in a year and a half, and it's really fun to be back and be part of the community here in the lectures, which I got to come to and be a part of when I was a student and worked out here, and so this is special for me, and it's really an honor to be able to talk to you. And I was asked to talk about this topic, Go and Do During the Change of the World, which is a book that I wrote about 4 years ago now, I think. And while I was working here at Pepperdine, this came out. And so I wanted to talk about that and some of the things that we sort of learned conceptually, principles about getting things done, strategic things done around the world, and also tell you about one of my heroes of faith and sort of someone I hope you can get to know through me as well, and it's related to another book that I put out recently. So what I thought I'd do is just start by giving you a little bit of my own background and story to give you a little context on who I am and before we get rolling. But I alluded to being a Pepperdine grad. I went to the law school and the business school. It started here in 2004, graduated in 2008, and then stayed on and directed our global justice program at the law school. And I was looking at some of the Pepperdine materials, and they had this brochure, Lives Changed, and I resonated with that because I feel like this is a place that changed my life. When I came here from undergrad, I hadn't really thought about this idea of vocation and calling, and that career was really something that you thought strategically about how it might be purposeful. And that was new to me. And then I got here to law school, and we had this all these lawyers coming in who were talking about making a difference in the world and what that meant, and these stories of lawyers who were out in India and Thailand and Africa, and they were rescuing people out of brothels and closing jails that were horrendous. And it was just this thing that I knew I wanted to be a part of, and it just felt so meaningful and so purposeful. And so we went, and I started traveling during law school, went to Thailand and Burma and Uganda and Rwanda and Haiti and all these places doing justice sort of work. And the story that I felt in this desire was this universal story, I felt, that so many people that were my age, my category in this phase of life, were thinking and feeling the same things, this desire, but not sure where to go with it or what to do with it. And so we started this global justice program at the law school, and it became something bigger, but to really try to catalyze that, try to put something strategic together for people to do, to go and do something. And so, and now I'm actually teaching at a school in Minnesota, and I've worked with people of all ages, and this idea is just, this desire is just universal. And so part of what we've been writing about and what this is about is how to put something to that. And the theme of this, of the Bible lectures in, what does it mean to serve the orphan and the widow? What does it mean? But how do we actually do that? How do we get to the do part faith is where we were really trying to resolve something. So, I mentioned that I started going out, and I was doing all this work around the world. I was in Thailand and working with children who'd been caught up in human trafficking and were in brothels or they were stateless, and it was a very powerful experience. And we started developing this initiative in Africa, and Pepperdine talks some about this, but we would we'd actually go out into the bush in Uganda and Rwanda, and we started going there and developing some programs with the Ugandan judiciary where we would addressing sort of some systemic problems. And we heard about these places in rural Africa where there were prisons, where kids were languishing. And we didn't know much about it because no one really spoke about it. It was sort of rumor, right? I mean, you sort of hear these rumblings about there are these places out there. And so we went. We didn't know what we were going to find. We just got on this plane to make a trip over there, and we came up to this building. We were taken to this little building in the middle of absolute nowhere. And if you know where, like, Gulu, Uganda is from the Kampala, there's this, like, six-hour drive, and it's smack in the middle of that, but way off near the Congolese border. And so we approached this little building, and we started seeing, you know, there's this hole, and there's these faces below this lock. And we entered, and there was this, it was this prison that was tiny. And these kids were just sitting in this, I mean, it was like a Hollywood movie set. You couldn't quite believe it. Like, this is, like, someone designed this. Like, this isn't really a prison. It's made up, right? But it's not. It was real. And these kids were sitting there 23 out of 24 hours a day in darkness, just languishing. And they weren't supposed to be there. Most of them had been there for, you know, a year to 2 years because they just didn't have a lawyer that showed up. No one bothered to come. The kids' cases were just too hard, and no lawyer wanted to take them because kids were scared on the witness stand. There were all these reasons, and so we started putting together the cases and briefing them and preparing them and getting them through the system, and we ended up, you know, releasing 23 kids back to freedom, who most of them were just dismissed because they stole a pack of gum, they'd been there a year, you've served your time. Or even they'd passed the maximum 2 years sentence for a juvenile in Uganda. And so it was really this experience, this very intense experience of feeling like your vocation and law that we'd been working on. We took these lawyers with us, you know, that we were really doing something that was the hands and feet of Jesus. And we felt like we met God in a special way. And so we wanted to try to expand that, and that's what we've been doing. I no longer direct the program, but it's continuing and continuing to do this kind of work. And it's fantastic, right? And these are the things that we want to encourage people to do and figure out how to get to that point. Well, Uganda led me to something else, and that is one of my heroes who really embodies this notion of go and do. And I want to tell you that story. And to tell you how I got to this hero, I have to tell you a little bit of the background. That I was in Uganda for one of these trips, and we went over to Kilimanjaro in Tanzania and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, which was a really fun experience because I love climbing and doing things outdoors. And we're trekking up and down this mountain, and you look back and in front of you, and it's just these lines of porters. You know, they're in flip flops and they're carrying bags on their heads, and then they have this process, right? It's just, this is how they do it, and you're required to do it this way. You have to hire porters, and they set up the tents and they set up your dinner and everything before you get to the campsite for that day, and then they run your stuff ahead the next day. And it's wild, but I remember thinking this can't be much different than how explorers started opening up Africa. Right. It's got to be similar. So I'm up on Kilimanjaro, and, you know, Africa's pretty good cell phone service. I was trying to get on the internet. Didn't work. But I was trying to get on with my phone and, like, download a book because I wanted to find a book on the African explorers and like, what that experience was like. And the only name I knew was David Livingstone. And I don't know why I knew it. Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Is that cultural, right? We know that phrase, and somehow that resonates. It stuck with us. And so when I got down from the mountain and got back to the U.S., this was the first thing I did is I went looking for a book on this person. I knew he had something to do with Christian faith, and he was an explorer, but that was all I knew. And it was the only name that I knew, and, you know, if I could have come up with another explorer's name, that might have been someone I would have looked for. So I found some very dense biographies, and I found these nuggets about how he was somehow interested in ending the slave trade in Africa. But nothing more than that. There was just these nuggets on it. And part of it was that all the biographers who'd written about him were mostly secular, and they weren't really interested. They were a little bit suspicious of his faith and his motivations. And so I started doing more research. I'm like, well, this is interesting, right? This guy is an adventurer. He was climbing mountains and rafting down rivers. And he was a man of deep faith who wrote a lot about his faith. And he had an interest in justice, in abolition. Like, this is my man. Yeah, I like this guy. And So I wanted to find that book that told me about his nexus of these things. And so I went looking for it, and I didn't find anything. I came up completely empty-handed that was a story that had just had been lost. And what I did find was that he spoke out against slavery. He died lost and alone in the jungle. And almost 30 days after his death, slavery was completely abolished in Africa. And I figured there had to be some connection between these things. Part of this too is I think that we are, I think in faith right now we're looking for heroes, right? And this is someone who did heroic things. I knew there was a story there that had to be told, and that this is something that that we might want to know. Well, this led to this book on, it's called The Daring Heart of David Livingstone that I published in the fall. And I want to tell you just a little slice of his story and then some principles out of his story, because it's a story that that we don't know. That he's a hero of faith who we fully lost over some generations. But we have so much to learn from him now, and he's someone that I think can really inspire us once again. Well, he was born in Scotland. Livingstone was born in Scotland. He grew up in poverty and really child slavery in a sense. He was a piecer in the cotton mills and ended up, 12 hours a day for pennies putting together pieces of shards of cotton, if you will. Education took him out of it and he felt a call. He went to medical school and seminary and then felt a call to missions. And so he went off as a missionary to Africa, and he went to these mission posts and had these bases in South Africa, and he would he'd look out over the hillside and see all these fires, these smoke rising from fires, and wonder, what is going on there? How come we don't go out to the people? And so he started doing these incredible treks to go out to villages to meet people, to evangelize. He ended up walking from South Africa up through Central Africa, was the first person in history to cross the Kalahari Desert on foot, walked across, then crossed back across the entire continent, coast to coast, and finished this just incredible trek. Along the way, was the first European to see Victoria Falls. He experimented and really discovered the malaria prophylaxis with quinine. He was put on a scientist hat and documented the tsetse fly. Just made incredible geographic and scientific discoveries along the way. And he dreamed of this Christian continent. Now, unfortunately, and I talked about some of these modern biographers, they love to criticize him because they say he only converted one person to Christianity, who ended up relapsing back to animism. But I think that, we have this understanding today of that Christian missions isn't necessarily always about evangelism. But he was more interested in going out and starting to build these roads for missionaries to follow him, and essentially became an accidental explorer along the way. He didn't try to be an explorer. He wanted to be a missionary, but he was exploring sort of by default of what he was accomplishing. Well, he made several trips. As you can imagine, these things he did crossing Africa. He came back to Europe, to Britain, just a hero. He was, the astronauts had come from back from the moon. I mean, equivalent to that. Everyone wanted to know everything about him. He funded his next trip after that, and it completely collapsed. His next expedition completely collapsed. The crumbling leadership that he displayed, suspicious motivations that he had. His team just fell apart, and it was a very troublesome expedition. But he along the way he witnessed the slave trade. Now, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that slavery in Africa is more complicated than just our involvement in the transatlantic slave trade that we've heard about, right? We know that we know that the U.S. and Britain were involved in this trade that went from the west coast of Africa over to the United States and Europe. But when that was shut down, you know, the slave traders are resilient, and they decided to go the other way. And so they started going out through the east. The Arab slave traders took over, and out through the island of Zanzibar, they had this great slave market, and then they, through the Congo and all of Central Africa, they just started raiding and capturing people and just did horrific things. I mean, they would, and then they would send out the slaves to plantations in the Indian Ocean, the Arab Peninsula, sort of other places that were removed from, you know, the slaves weren't coming to the United States. They weren't coming to Europe. And so we really had no, you know, sort of a, I don't see it, I don't care about it philosophy. We're not involved. And, even though Livingstone's expedition was spiraling into kind of a disaster, he had documented this slave trade and decided that this is what he wanted to dedicate his life to, because it was horrific. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were being killed or taken a year, and they would take people. They would essentially, the slave traders would double the amount of people they thought they would have at the end, and then they would just kill them for sport along the way to make a point. I mean, it's just a horrific, more horrific than we'd seen really anywhere else in the world. Well, Livingstone returned to Britain as sort of the persona non grata. He had this failed expedition that wasted a lot of money and a lot of time and lives, and it was obviously recalled. But while he was away on that expedition, a new important geographic question had arisen in the world. And that question was, where does the Nile River begin? And the Nile River is, you know, it's arguably the most, well, it is the most important river in the world historically, right? I mean, it's sort of where all, so much of civilization began, and we've got the, you know, Moses, and we just have these incredible stories that came up, that happened along the Nile River, and you had just speculation throughout history of where it began, and the most the sort of historical view on it was that there was somewhere in the jungle in the middle of Africa, there were these great fountains that just rose up out of the ground, and this plume of water, and so, but no one had seen it. They don't, you know, there's so much travel and life along the Nile, but no one knew where it began. These explorers had gone. There weren't many good African explorers. That was quite the job. I mean, you're sick half the time that you're there and fighting malaria and these diseases. But they had had different theories arise, and so there were no explorers that hadn't taken a position on where the Nile began. And Livingstone had been gone during this whole debate. He got back, and so they said, well, you're not really well-liked right now, but you're the only guy who can do this trip. And so they put him up with very, very little funding, but sent him off to try to find the Nile. And Livingstone, part of what made my book important on this topic was that, and a lot of the secular biographers had seen this as Livingstone's decision to try to regain the limelight, to try to be a hero again, because he'd fallen from grace. And I found these letters, these sort of semi-lost letters, where he was admitting that, you know, this the only reason for him to go back and look for the Nile was so that he had a platform to speak about the slave trade. It was really a publicity stunt to try to find the Nile. Well, he goes off, and he goes back into Africa, and within, you know, weeks, he's destitute, sick. Most of his porters have absconded him or abandoned him. He went alone as the only European, and the only people that he has, that he can rely on, are the slave traders, the only ones who can feed him. And so we have this really interesting, complex dynamic where he ends up having to rely on the people he hates and take their food and go with them, and the head slave trader is at one point carrying him on his shoulders, and it's strange. And you see this whole kind of internal debate where he's wavering about what his purpose is and sort of desensitized to the slave trading and the killing that's around him, and becoming sort of obsessed with the Nile and trying to find that Nile is now the ultimate goal. And one thing that I love about this character, about Livingstone, is that he's he's so human to me. I mean, I can see like wrestling with the same questions of, am I doing these good things in the world for God, or okay, now they're getting attention. There are people, there's media that's interested in this story. What's it about now? And he really embodies this debate. Well, we have this turning point in Livingstone's life where he's visiting this village, and it's this market, and he likes to watch the market, and business is taking place now. The slave traders come in, and for no reason, they just start massacring the people. And within minutes, hundreds and hundreds of people are killed. People are trying to swim across the river, and they're just shooting them in the river. And it's just a horrible situation. And it's a turning point for him because he realizes his conscience catches up with him. And he says, I can't do this anymore. I can't follow the slave traders and continue to take their food and to take their housing. And so he goes off on really what's almost a death march that he knows unlikely that he can make it. He's so sick, and he goes to a place where he had set up some food and some supplies to meet him, planned a meeting point. And he arrives there, and they've all been stolen. Everything's gone. He's got nothing. He's completely destitute and sick. And Livingstone waits for death to arrive. He's just, dysentery's caught up, and it's a matter of days now. Well, all of this has happened. And Livingstone has been lost. He has not been in contact with anyone in Europe. And all these rumors are coming out about him. There are rumors that he's married an African princess. There are rumors that he's alive in South Africa. I mean, he's sort of like Elvis, right? You know, we love it when we hear these rumors about people and you don't want to believe what's happened to him. He sort of becomes this mythical, and they actually thought he was dead for a while. I mean, they were convinced, there was another room that convinced he was dead. And he becomes this mythical figure. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness actually was inspired by Livingstone as a character, and this idea that he was maybe lost in the jungle and starting this empire, right? Where he was leading these tribes. Well, people are not only interested in Livingstone as a person, but they're becoming interested in what he stood for and why he went back into Africa and why he got lost. And as Livingstone is waiting for death in this village, he hears gunshots ring out. And he starts seeing these porters come in, and they're carrying boats and bathtubs and food, and he's destitute, and this is he's on his deathbed practically, and this is amazing. And it's Henry Morton Stanley, an American journalist, and this is when this famous Dr. Livingstone, I presume, phrase comes in. And Henry Morton Stanley, he is a newspaper man, he was a writer for newspaper, chasing a sensational story. If he could beat the British back and find their own lost explorer and make headlines in the New York Herald, which became the New York Times, he would be this, he'd make his mark in journalism, and he'd have this story that would ring around the world, that he really accomplished what was the impossible. And even what the best British explorers couldn't do was try to rescue Livingstone. Well, Stanley can't persuade him to come back, can't persuade him to return to Europe. And Livingstone wants to continue his work. He doesn't want to be a failure again, but he does write several op-eds to send out with Stanley. And the op-eds are about the slave trade, about documenting what's happened and the atrocious, horrendous things that have taken place in Africa. And the op-ed is really an admonition to the world to end the slave trade no matter the cost. Well, Stanley's announcement of Livingstone being alive rang around the world. I was pulling newspaper reports of this from Australia and India, and everywhere the newspapers were covered, this story was on the headlines. This was he died in 1873, this was around 1872. Yeah. And so all over the world, this story is just making waves. And he really ignites this public outcry again in abolition. that people are fascinated by him, fascinated by what he stood for, and that that so much pressure that they want the British government to step in when it's not even their own situation, when it's nothing that they've caused or been a part of, and do something about this. Livingstone, of course, is still in the jungle. He knows nothing about this. And he's continuing his quest for the source of the Nile, going deeper and deeper and getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And dysentery eventually puts him in a place where he can no longer walk, no longer move, and his porters carry him to this village, and he collapses. And Livingstone is on his deathbed, and the porters find him. A couple days later, he's kneeling beside the bed, and he's not moving, and he's kneeling in prayer. He's not moving. And they sit, and they wait, and they watch, and he doesn't move, and they come up, and they find that he's passed. Well, as porters, in one of my favorite parts of the story, they decide England's going to want the body back. But he really didn't belong in Britain. So they take his body, and they cut out his heart, and they bury it under under a tree, and they make this plaque. They carve this plaque into the tree that Livingstone's heart should stay in Africa. Well, his letters of work and his body arrives in there, and it is just this outpouring of abolitionist spirit in England again. You know, back in, you know, we know the Wilberforce story, and it's again, and so it works, and his letters, his op-eds start this worldwide outcry to end the slave trade. Britain, as a result of this and all the pressure that they face, they negotiate a treaty with the Sultan of Zanzibar to lawfully end slave trade in Africa, and then they send their ships to blockade the great slave market on Zanzibar to put a final nail in the coffin of slavery. And that's it. This history of slavery in Africa is ended because of this man's work. Now, he knew nothing about it. I mean, he died lost and alone, knowing nothing of the success, knowing nothing that, you know, thinking that he was a failure. In his last letters, it was these stories about how he what has his life come to and what has he accomplished. But yet all this had taken place. And so my book and my research was really tracing this direct line of causation to Livingstone, and that he had done these incredible things, and that everything that he wanted and came to fruition. He had this vision for a Christian Africa, and so much of sub-Saharan Africa is Christian. If you've been to Africa or spent time there, you'll often meet people, their first name is Livingstone. It's wild. There are cities named Livingstone. And it was in the places that he had started some of these outposts. He had the slave market on Zanzibar was torn down. And one of my favorite, it's just beautiful, but they tore down the slave market. They took the largest stone in the slave market. They built the first Christian church there on that spot, using the main stone, the largest stone, as the cornerstone of the church. I just think it's so beautiful. And they went to the places, they went to the epicenter of the slave trade and started Livingstonia, this city that's quite a major city in Africa now, named after him. And so when I started this project, I didn't know that I'd like him. I didn't expect, kind of based on what I'd heard about him and some of the things. I just wanted to find a book on it. And when I couldn't find the story, I decided, well, it's got to be written. It's got to be told. But I've come up with sort of five things that I learned from Livingstone that I think are practical and have an analog to lessons we've learned in the with the Global Justice Program and all this work around the world. And first one is about looking for the gaps. I was talking with our program manager for the Global Justice Program that I started at the law school, and she said, you know, you still have all these students who come and they want to change the world. And I think that we get lost in this idea that it's just this big, we feel like we have to change the world or we haven't accomplished something, right? Or that's what we celebrate. That's what we give Nobel Peace Prizes to. I don't think that should be our goal. I think that's too daunting, too overwhelming. And I love, you know, this Ezekiel 22:30, where God looks out in the world and he looks for someone to just stand in the gaps, right? And I see what Livingstone did as standing in the gap. That there was this gap. There was no one else in Africa who could talk about what was happening in the slave trade. There was no one else who could speak about this. And if you actually look at what Livingstone did directly to end the slave trade, he freed 24 people on one incident. He came across a group of slaves and he freed them once. That was it. 24 people. So he didn't actually go around closing all these, you know, locking away all these slave traders. He just stood in the gap. He spoke about it and he helped in a small way in a tiny, tiny place. I feel like what we've done in Uganda and these other places is really just standing in the gap. We've looked at, here's one prison with 23 kids. I don't know if we can fix the whole justice system in this country because it's screwed up. We're trying. And it's starting to actually have some move that way a little bit. But it started at least with just, we got this one kid named Henry and another kid named Joseph, and they're locked in jail, and let's get them out. And then we'll see where this goes from there. But this is the gap. It's just this one person. Two is this, the second is this idea of being present. This is something that I've been thinking about a lot this year. So I think we find these gaps, right? Like if we say, okay, well, find the gaps. Where are they? I think it's about trying to go places and be present. When we went to, we started getting involved in Uganda. We actually, a group of us flew over. They said, well, bring us law books. We need law books for our library. And we packed up a bunch of old textbooks in the library that we didn't need anymore. And we flew over with them. And the judges were shocked. They didn't know what to do because they're like, we didn't expect you to show up again or bring books. And we just showed up. We didn't know what we were doing. But then they still talk about that. They still cite that as like, this is when we knew you were serious, was that you came back with these books. And it's just bizarre. That was the thing that mattered to them. And it was just about showing up and being present. It really wasn't about establishing anything significant. When I think about Jesus' life and the things he did, it seemed like he did a lot of just showing up and being present places. You know, we don't have these, like, we sort of have record of Jesus like having strategic planning sessions with his disciples, right? I mean, trying to figure out a marketing plan, right? It was, you know, don't tell anyone was his marketing plan. But we have a lot of them just showing up at the wedding, at the tax collector's house, you know, where he has these great interactions with the sinful woman. And you know, these are some of the most remarkable stories of just being present. Henry Nouwen wrote this thing that's been powerful to me where he said, my own desire to be useful and do something significant or to be a part of an impressive project is so strong it takes all my time. But I wonder if more and more we shouldn't just know people by name, eat, to drink with them, to listen to their stories, tell your own, to let them know with words, handshakes, and hugs that you not simply like them but truly love them. When I look at what Livingstone did, you know, there's this criticism of he didn't convert enough people. He didn't free enough slaves. He could have freed more people. He decided not to in a lot of cases. But he was just with people. He was just with the slave traders. And I've got to think that the slave traders were impacted somehow by his presence. And there's a story I tell at the end of the book where this missionary is coming back through Africa following, you know, years after Livingstone's death. And this chief really wants to meet this missionary. And he said, you're from Europe. You're one of Livingstone's brothers. This is a coat that I've held on. It's my most prized possession. I want to give it to you. And it was Livingstone's jacket that he'd left years and years before. And there was just this wake that Livingstone had left through Africa. And, you know, he didn't evangelize to that many people. But I want to believe that 95% of sub-Saharan Africa that's Christians, largely due to his presence, and that he left something that people wanted to be a part of. A lot of this being present concept, my third lesson from Livingstone is thinking about being an ambassador. you know, Paul calls us ambassadors for Christ, and I think he's talking all about sharing the gospel, but I love this idea of being an ambassador, because we've gotten to work with a lot of ambassadors around the world in this program, and what they do, and they do a lot of good, what they do is they're just present. Like, they just are in a country, and they've got a house, and they host people for dinner, and they go out to open up schools, and they're just there talking about the mission of the United States. And they're just supposed to be present. They don't necessarily have a marketing plan or something that they're supposed to accomplish. They're just there in places. And, you know, we're seeing the world changing. Governments are really ineffective. The UN is practically worthless. And I think that there's this idea of private diplomacy, that we're these next sort of round of ambassadors. This is what we've been doing at Pepperdine, at the Global Justice Program, and I think it's been changing the way justice is done in Uganda. And it's interesting the amount of power we can even have. I mean, we've met with sitting presidents in African nations and places, and you know, just going and asking them, and it's surprising how far you can get when you actually ask. My recommendation to send a fax. You know. You try to email people these days. It's amazing what you can get done with a fax, because no one knows what to do with them. Like, email is so easy to delete, but you get a fax. Everyone still has a fax machine in these offices. And a fax shows up, and they're like, "I don't know what to do with it." Like, do we throw this away or do we respond? And so it's funny how that works. But I love thinking about this as kind of the showing up idea, as being, oh, there's something more professional about it. And this idea of an ambassador has just been powerful to me. And then fourth would be developing expertise. There are a lot of these gaps, and I think we have a tendency to be overbroad. A lot of students will come in often and say, "I want to go to law school so I can solve human trafficking." And they just sort of look at them like, I don't know what to tell you, because we don't need lawyers to fix human trafficking. Like, there really isn't that job. We need experts in counseling for sexual abuse. We need experts in psychology and psychiatry who can help individuals recover from these situations. In Uganda, we need experts. We don't just need lawyers. We need experts in plea bargaining who can help tell the country, figure out how to solve that. I started doing a lot of work in the country of Burma, and I got to tell this little story, is that I took kind of a deep dive into Burma and sort of writing things about it. And the traditional way you really become an expert on something these days is still writing and publishing. And so I want to encourage anyone, you know, to think about, rather than sort of having these broad strokes, like, figure out what is the one or two things that are really interesting and narrow and niche, and then just start writing about those things and talking about them and becoming the one person. And so I got to be sort of this guy on the genocide that was happening against the Karen people in Burma. And so I got this call one day that they needed an expert witness in a legal case about this topic. And so I'm on the phone with this judge, and he's swearing me in, and they're like, "You're the Burma expert now." And I'm like, "I'm an expert in an entire nation." And so I'm testifying about the conditions in this country. But I got to help this one person who was a refugee in the United States who needed some legal help and needed an expert to testify. They couldn't find one. It was because I took this deep dive into Burma. And then we got this call from this Burma organization. They're like, "Hey, come out to Pasadena and help us with something." We show up, and it's the U2 concert, and they're like, "Yeah, we need some Burma people, and we need you to go up on stage with Bono and U2, and you guys are like gonna have these do this thing." And so I got to be on stage with Bono, because I took this deep dive into Burma and, you know, found this niche that no one else had done any writing and publishing and thinking about. And suddenly, you know, people start calling because there's no one else to call. And so, I just think it's about, it's less about trying to know everything and more, for me at least, about trying to know a lot about a few things. And then finally, the last thing that is kind of my big lesson from Livingstone is this idea of keep going, right? Of never surrendering. Livingstone died alone, lost, not knowing, thinking he hadn't accomplished anything, thinking he had failed his family, thinking he had failed as an explorer, thinking he had failed as an abolitionist, everything. But yet this whole, 30 days later, after his death, he had no idea. 30 days later, slavery ended. His life goal, for a decade, he knew nothing about this, but this thing was happening, and it was all because of him and because of his, the things he was passionate about and working on, and that was infectious, and he never knew it. And so it makes me think about, what are the things that I'm doing, and I may not see, who they're impacting or what life they have beyond me, but to just keep going at them, even if they don't seem like they're bearing fruit, there may be this greater fruit that's somewhere. And I haven't seen, and that's the story, and the Livingstone, his life has really reminded me of this over and over, that the things we do here, we don't necessarily know them, but there's this greater story arc that God has, and we might get to be a part of it. Well, I'm about out of time, but I'd be happy to take some questions if it's on these five things we talked about, or if it's on the life of Livingstone. It's just a pleasure to talk about this person and the story, and I'd love to answer any questions. Maybe this wasn't what you were expecting when you came to this. I don't know, but I hope at least you walk away learning something about, if nothing else, this person. I think is a hero for our faith, and we should revisit. So yeah. That's what we think. He was kneeling by his bedside in what appeared to be prayer. And so, he had quit journaling at that point. And so we just know from what his porters, his assistants had how they'd seen him. But I want to believe he was.
Let's go with that.
That's what I think. I mean, that's what I wrote in the book. So, yeah. Yeah.
That gives me great comfort because we often don't.
Right.
Yeah,
right. I know. I've been away for a year and a half, but came back up to the law school and got to the law school, and I got to start this program here, and it was sort of weird to see it continuing, and that you got to have this little way that you helped shape something, and that it's. That this program that we started, we were just trying to get people into it at the beginning. 70% of the students coming into the law school are citing it as the thing that is drawing them to Pepperdine's program. And like, okay, maybe we did some good. Who knows?
Yeah. That's
where
I love this.
By
Bob Goff.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, in this prison, I mean, Bob's out to the prison too with us. We've worked with Bob on several programs. He comes and teaches some things at the law school sometimes. He wasn't involved in this project specifically, but has been involved a lot in the Uganda stuff. And
was his timing before yours?
Here when I was working here, I got to bring him in to hire him to teach him or to teach at the school. So he came in after I was here, but. He had been doing some things in Uganda before us, and that sort of helped bring us in a little bit. So it's a tight-knit community in these places. Yeah, yeah.
He came in and gave a presentation
mm-hmm.
when Ken was still at
yep.
the school.
Yep.
So you and I sat at that presentation.
And we started sending some people with him to...
Changing
mm-hmm.
for everybody there.
Mm-hmm.
When Bob came yeah. to speak that time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And that's, other thing, I mean, he came and talked one time, and it starts all these this ripple effect
mm-hmm.
that.
It was a huge ripple effect.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else I can answer?
Where's your book?
Well, I thought they said they'd have some out here somewhere, but I don't know how that works. So maybe I was supposed to bring them. I didn't get that memo if I was, but I came on a plane, so that's my entire bag of stuff there, and. I didn't want to fit any books in anyway, but it's not, if anybody wants to get in touch at all, or you're interested in the book or something, I mean, the Daring Heart of David Livingstone is the book. Thomas Nelson put it out, real reputable, We've had a lot of good people who signed on with it to endorse it. And I'd be happy to connect if I can do anything for you or something to want to talk about. It'd be great. But yeah. Yeah, you can. It's in every Barnes and Noble. They usually have a couple. Amazon, obviously, get anything on Amazon. But yeah, it's in. They usually have a couple on the shelves at every Barnes and Noble. So at least the Livingstone one. This one is a couple years older, so you know they rotate off for new stuff pretty quickly. But yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, and it's wonderful to talk with you. So thank you.